Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. As you know, we've begun every show for the last couple of months with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified in 2019 before the impeachment hearings. I was so impressed with his patriotism, and we need that kind of patriotism now when we see our commander-in-chief, who frankly I think is the definition of traitor. But anyway, let's hear the testimony of Lieutenant
Next month Colonel will Vindman. Mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us as he does so regularly, and we're so grateful, is John Nichols of The Nation magazine. He's prolific. He writes books. He gives speeches. He is one of the most thoughtful commentators I know. You wrote a piece, John Nichols, about the idea of this moment being a movement and that the movement is winning. I was thinking about the idea of this movement. It brought me back to when I sort of got involved in sort of national politics by running for governor in 1992. Do you know what this made me realize? I'm going to tell you a story. Bill Clinton is running for president. He's running as a new Democrat. I didn't know I even understood what that meant. But I came to understand it as I watched him through the primary. And I think I've told you this story before. I called my staff one day and I said to them, so who's this Clinton guy from Arkansas? And they said, well, he's the governor. I said, no, I want to know more about him. And they said, why? I said, because every time I walk into a room where Bill and Hillary are, under one arm is the insurance lobbyist, and under the other arm is the banking lobby. And I'm thinking, I fight those lobbyists all the time. I've been doing that for like almost 8 years now. Why are they ushering him into every room? Well, what I began to realize is that what he ushered into the Democratic Party was the money party. And now we have the movement party. And I am so grateful. So welcome to the program, Mr. Nichols.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Arnie. And I love your story. People who have listened to us over the years know that we met when you were preparing to run for governor. That is a very, very long time ago. It will tell everyone something about your approach that we met at a huge rally in Keene, New Hampshire for Ralph Nader.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Nader 2000. This was Nader attempting to run a write-in campaign in the New Hampshire primary, encouraging people to write him in the Democratic or Republican primary, not because he thought he was going to become president, but because he thought it was incredibly important in 1992 to raise the issues of money in politics, and also to say that that money in politics, that that corporate influence on our politics was going to affect our jobs, our access to health care, our environment, every fundamental issue. And it wasn't that it wasn't already affecting it, but I emphasize that line was going to affect it, because what Nader was saying was we were on the cusp of an explosion of corporate money in our politics, of an explosion of billionaire money in our politics, that it would warp our politics, and that the most damaging warpage would not be this policy or that, you know, approach, you know, the deregulation of our media, which has in so many ways destroyed so much of media. Deregulation all over the place, the cutting down of the role of government where it needed to be increased. It wasn't the individual things. It was the narrowing of the discourse.
Yes.
Exactly.
Exactly. Oh my God. I go back to that Keene rally. And one of the things that people need to, so Ralph Nader is running and he's handing out pencils. Yes. And on the pencils, John, it says none of the above. He wasn't just that he was prescient. I was beginning to feel it, but then it became a tsunami after Clinton got elected. And remember, Clinton didn't win a majority of the votes.
No, he actually didn't.
I don't think he would have won. I really don't. And yet what he ushered in with this whole sort of idea of, you know, the concept of big government is over, and we saw the deregulation of derivatives, and we saw the quote-unquote welfare reform and the criminal reform and all those things. And then you kind of look today in 2020 and realize that it was both money that kind of infected our politics, but that it didn't as much, I don't think, harm Republicans as much as it harmed Democrats, which, as you point out, narrowed the conversation so it wasn't full-throated anymore. It was basically bookended by billionaires on either side.
That was the point of the book that I've written that's out now, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party, argues that, you know, again and again, you have these moments, these critical junctures where the country's going to go one way or the other. And too frequently, the Democrats pull their punches. They say, well, we'll work within this system, or in the case of Clinton, we'll actually become a part of the system and fully embrace it and advance most of its agenda. And in effect, they do two things. One, they weaken the Democratic Party because it is not capable of delivering a message so resilient and so resounding that it can overwhelm, you know, frankly, the very negative messages, even then, in the early 90s, from the Republicans, and then messages that have gotten worse and worse and uglier. But the second thing it does is it weakens the nation, and we need to understand that. When the Democrats stand down, if you accept that the Democratic Party has some better principles, some better ideals, at least, you know, at its most noble, at its most idealistic, if it stands down, who is there in the electoral arena to stand up, right? What happens? We marginalize our third parties. You know, the Republican Party has moved further and further to the right. If the Democrats aren't fighting, then we don't act on climate in the way that we have to. Right. We don't act on healthcare in the way that we have to. We don't act on racial injustice and the completely, you know, out of control criminal justice system in this country, which has done so much damage. You know, we, in fact, sometimes even accelerate the damage, right, if the Democrats don't stand up. So that brings us to the moment that we are in, because I think when Bernie Sanders ran for president in 2015, 2016, that will always be the operative moment. You know, many people run for president one time, then they run again. It's not to diminish the second run, but it is that first incredible moment where you're like, whoa, hold it, this is possible? When he ran in 2015, 2016, you know, it's like, this isn't the way it's supposed to be, and it isn't supposed to be the way Republicans operate, and it isn't supposed to be the way Democrats operate. He was, people were like, well, you're being horrible. You're saying horrible things about Hillary Clinton. No, he wasn't saying horrible things about Hillary Clinton. He was saying horrible things about the Democratic Party. It went much deeper. Much more fundamental. It wasn't about personalities. Exactly. It was actually a far more stinging indictment than a personalized campaign would have been. And the interesting thing about it is that it is like the children's story, the emperor has no clothes, right? When one person will actually say, you know, the emperor has no clothes, suddenly everybody recognizes this reality, even if they wanted to deny it before that. They also realize that they can speak up. The Atlantic magazine recently asked me to write about what Bernie Sanders' legacy was. This was at the point when he suspended his campaign. Okay. Now, the fact is, I think Bernie Sanders continues to write his legacy. This week, he's going to fight on reducing the military budget in some fundamental ways. So I'm not saying he's done, but the legacy of his campaigns. And the argument I made was that Bernie won. And he won a huge victory. But the legacy of his campaigns is, you know, the people who supported him in 2016, or who were sympathetic to the ideas that he raised, who said, okay, I can do that. There's a wonderful commentator, Benjamin Dixon, who has a podcast out of Atlanta, I believe. Just a brilliant, brilliant guy. And when Bernie stood down in 2020, he said, you know, thanks, we'll take it from here.
Exactly. And exactly.
Yeah. And that's, so I think that there's no question that AOC, who had worked on Bernie's campaign in 2016 and then went to Standing Rock and suddenly decided, well, you know what, I think I'm going to run for Congress. She took it from there. So did Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and other folks. And then this year, so many more people have stood up. You know, there are going to be wins and losses. That's the important thing to understand. Charles Booker, it became clear on Tuesday that he had not won the race, narrowly defeated for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate in Kentucky. And he was one person that really excited folks. And some folks will say, well, yeah, it doesn't work everywhere. Yeah, of course it doesn't work everywhere. But Jamal Bowman, nominated in New York, or sure to be nominated now.
Yes, Engel.
Defeating Elliot Engel, an incumbent. You know, all these other candidates, especially in New York, who've stood up and won. But those aren't the ones I focus on. I want to emphasize this, just to circle around here. The people I'm really excited about is there was a DA candidate in rural Colorado who defeated an incumbent DA yesterday in a Colorado primary, endorsed by Bernie Sanders, but also running on a criminal justice reform platform in a rural area. There are legislative candidates across this country running and winning. There are, you know, something real is happening out there. And if you were running this year, Arnie, which I wish you were, if you were running this year, Arnie, we would be able to say what you were. You know, not who you are. We know who you are. But we would say, oh, Arnie Arneson, she's a part of this movement. She's a part of this thing that is rising.
So let me talk a little bit about the movement from the very beginning, because I use my hands all the time, and this is a radio show, everyone. I so apologize. But you talked about how they narrowed the conversation. And I reminded people in 1992, after I lost, that what was so important about my running was that I expanded an opportunity in my state to have a more full-throated conversation. That until someone like me ran, who was, as you know, incredibly progressive at a time when there wasn't really anyone except for maybe a handful of people in New Hampshire, and I felt so alone. But then when I got more votes than any Democrat in history, even losing, they were like, whoa, what does that say? My problem was that Clinton also won at the same time. And therefore, Clinton kind of reinforced the opposite of what I had been saying as I was running. But what I see happening with Bernie is that Bernie did exactly right. He did win. He did win. He pulled off the scab. He liberated the voices. So many of us who had sort of thought, you know, is it even possible, realized, as that commentator you pointed out in Atlanta says, we can take it from here now, Bernie. He's absolutely right. There has been a torch passed. And what's fabulous is it's been passed to so many people at so many different levels of politics across the 50 states, and they get it. That's the most important thing, John, is they understand what they're supposed to do, and they're doing it with such level of excitement at a time we need their voices now more than ever.
You're exactly right. And, you know, we shouldn't diminish the fact that there were movements in 1992 and that you were a part of them. And that if you look back on, you know, anti-nuclear fights up in New Hampshire and other environmental struggles, if you look at the long fight over taxation in New Hampshire, what's interesting about it now is, and this is why I bring up Bernie Sanders, it's not to, you know, get excited about an individual or a personality, but people do need to see what is possible.
Yes.
They need to hit that. That's what you did when you ran for governor. That's what many people who don't win an election do. They show it is possible to compete in that election.
And that's what Booker did in Kentucky. What Booker did, let me just say something. Booker did not lose. What Booker did, and the reason I say this is I know Amy McGrath won. I get it. Amy McGrath was the anointed. She had more money than God. She was, you know, I mean, if you could almost have a cookie cutter DNC candidate, Amy McGrath is perfect for that. And therefore, they thought she was perfect in Kentucky. What is so amazing, I actually interviewed a reporter about Booker almost 2.5, 3 months ago, John, before anybody knew who he was. And this guy was telling me, you've got to pay attention to this guy, Arnie. You've got to pay attention to this guy. And I'm listening to him and I'm going, God, he sounds fabulous, but he doesn't have a shot, okay? Well, obviously the political landscape changed. And the fact that he came within 2 points of a person who is so well known, so well healed financially for this campaign, means that Amy McGrath is going to change too. Because Booker didn't just almost beat her. She is now aware of what he did. And that is going to change the kind of senator she is if she beats Mitch McConnell.
She's also going to need that yes. energy that yes. he brought to it. And, you know, already people are talking about noting that the huge vote he got in Louisville and surrounding areas and the prospect that perhaps he'll run for mayor or some other position. I mean, Charles Booker is young.
Yes.
And, already, you know, fully prepared. If he'd been the nominee, he would have been a great nominee. If he got to the Senate, he'd be a great senator. He will be something else. He will mm-hmm. he will rise up.
Absolutely.
And that's one way of looking at it, one way of thinking about it. The other thing that's important in this is the notion of a relay race, right? That we hand off the baton.
Yeah.
And if you've ever run a relay race, and I did when I was in high school, some, I was never the finisher, right? At best, I was, you know, like the second person, because they knew if I didn't do a very good job and handed it off, somebody who was a better runner, you know, could make up the distance, right? I see really, truthfully, the last 75 years as a relay race. Franklin Roosevelt, he got across the line. He wasn't perfect. He was very flawed in a whole bunch of ways, did things that not everybody approved of, and I understand all that. But the truth is that what was done with the New Deal and then defeating fascism during World War II was incredible, and it showed people that they could dream in ways they hadn't thought before. And that also, it frankly eased a great deal of pain at critical moments. It changed our politics. From there on, I think the Democratic Party has pulled its punches on a regular basis. It's had some great moments. At its best, the Great Society, voting rights, civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, war on poverty, the creation of public broadcasting. You run down the list of what Johnson did in a few years. It's quite incredible. You can point to other moments along the way. But the truth of the matter is the Democratic Party has not fully realized, hasn't begun to dream in the ways it should dream. And I see it as a relay race. I wrote a book about Henry Wallace, and there's no question of that, about the anti-war campaigners, McCarthy and Kennedy in the 60s, McGovern in the 70s. You know, we keep going down the line. You know, Paul Wellstone, Russ Feingold, Arnie Arneson, and you keep going along the line. Shirley Chisholm, Ron Dellum. These people won a little bit. They were in the race. They didn't get everything they wanted. They didn't get all the way. You get now Bernie Sanders and AOC and Jamal Bowman. You know, they're getting, we're now in that, I like to think, we're now in that critical point where the baton really is being handed off for that last run. And and we don't know where the finish line is exactly, but boy, I can see that we're in the running.
An organization, I was looking at a tweet the other day, you need to look at the new poll that came out of Tufts. And it really is a remarkable poll of young people and the activism that has been inspired because of the pandemic, John. Mm-hmm. That because people have been sort of sheltering at home and they've been doing all these things, they've been paying attention to different things because they can't socialize in the normal way. And you have to look at this circle poll out of Tufts. But this woman tweeted something out, and she is the head of an organization that says run for something.
Yeah.
And I just want everyone to know that is how I've spent my entire life since I've lost, is I've encouraged people to run. And I keep telling them, you can't win unless you run. And losing is not the end of something. It means you try. It means someone can build on you. It means you can try again. But if you don't run, it never happens. It never happens. So what we are seeing now is with a huge number of African Americans that have run this time, with a significant number of trans people and women, they have won at the same level as regular white people. I'm just telling everyone, they haven't lost more. They haven't won more. They've run and they've won at the same. It is the same, which means what is that? That's an invitation to get into the fight.
I think there are many invitations to get into the fight. And I do think it's important to remember, you know, I keep coming back to Shirley Chisholm. I mean, I think about it this way. Shirley Chisholm was the first African-American woman elected to Congress. Really one of the earlier African-Americans to be elected to Congress. She did so out of Brooklyn, New York, in an area with machine politics and a lot of barriers, a lot of challenges. Did it in 1968. A year later, she broke with the Democratic Party to endorse John Lindsay for re-election as mayor of New York. I think it's a lost story to our history. She provided the critical support that, you know, Lindsay won that re-election narrowly, re-elected a liberal mayor rather than a very conservative Democrat, came back in with the Democrats just 4 years after she was elected to Congress, ran for president. So diminished, so dismissed, so left out. She was not treated with the respect that a candidate, any candidate, deserved in that race. Also, so visionary a candidate as she. But here's the interesting thing. Among her handful of delegates was a young, very young woman who she had talked into getting engaged with electoral politics, a young woman from California, Barbara Lee. Barbara Lee has obviously went on to serve in the legislature, in Congress, now one of the senior members of Congress, leading the fight, as she says, defund the military, to cut back military and spending in fundamental ways, but so many other struggles on HIV/AIDS and on new foreign policy, on policing, on women's rights, this incredible woman. And, you know, I have to tell you, when I watch Joe Biden, you know, make his list of folks, and I'm thrilled that he says he's going to nominate or choose a woman to be his running mate. I hope he chooses an African-American woman. But frankly, if I was putting the list together, I'd put Barbara Lee on that list. The thing is, I would say, and what I do say is that today, so many people look back on Shirley Chisholm and say, why didn't America recognize how incredible she was? Why wasn't she embraced in 1972? We know why. I mean, there was sexism and racism and all the other challenges, but still people say, why didn't it work better? Why wasn't there more? And part of it is, the first step is to run for something, but the second step is to believe. And that means that the candidate steps up, but other people have to believe in the possibility of their candidacy. We are now in a moment where an increasing number of people believe in the possibility of candidates who come from a wide variety of backgrounds, who are racially, ethnically diverse, who young people, progressives in places where you wouldn't expect. The door is opening. It's not open enough, but the candidates are stepping up. This is the critical thing.
It is now the candidates stepping up. I keep telling people that that's important. The door is opening, but you've got to walk through it. You've got to run the risk of walking through it. You know, I'll be there to push. I may be there to pull, but you've got to take the step.
Well, and then here's the next part is when that person steps through, the rest of us have to examine ourselves. Think about, have we become such pundits, right? That we only worry, oh, I don't see a poll that says that person can win, or my expectations don't tell me that person. No, we have to say, if someone steps through, we're going to be there with outstretched arms, or maybe in this era of social distancing, just an elbow. But we're going to say, hey, we're with you. I actually think that's the last stage of this. We've opened the door enough. People are pushing through. As Shirley Chisholm said, you know, if there's not a chair at the table, I'll bring my own, you know, not a chair for me. And so they're there. But now it's the job of all of us to stop being pundits, to stop living in the narrow political zones that we were taught to live in, and to believe in these candidacies. I fully believe, 100% believe, that if you were running now, if you were the Arnie Arneson of 1992, and you were running in 2020, the same kind of campaign, the same incredible vision, that you would win.
You're going to make me cry, but let me just tell you something. As you talk about Shirley Chisholm, and you know this, I'm going to post a YouTube video up when I post this on my Facebook page and the Attitudes Facebook page, everyone, because there's a YouTube video that's called A Conversation with Arnie Arneson. And the conversation with Arnie Arneson begins with, how did I get political? And the story is a story of Shirley Chisholm entering my life and giving a speech in white New Hampshire to a room of all 400 basically white women, and talking about poverty and politics and policy, and then talking about the fact that if you're frustrated with the policy you see and how it's not working for your clients, she then looked at us and said, then you have to get political. You have to run the risk of running, because it's the way you bring that experience and their voices to the table. And I swear to God, John, all 399 other people disappeared in that room. And Shirley Chisholm was talking to me. And that was the year that I decided that I would run. She changed my life forever. It's just amazing. I knew of her, but I'd never heard her. I'm from New York, but I hadn't met her there. I had to be in Concord, New Hampshire, in this incredibly Republican white state, to be introduced to Shirley Chisholm. And she changed my life. She changed my life. And when you see this YouTube video, you will see what a difference she made. I never got to say thank you. So thank you for letting me say thank you here.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to say thank you this year by, you know, back in Barbara Lee for vice president for as long as I genuinely believe we have to dream bigger.
We do have to dream bigger. And thank you. I needed this. I've been so morose. And the reason why I call John Nichols is that he gives me hope. So, Mr. Nichols, thank you for joining us. The Nation magazine is very lucky to have you. Keep being prolific and writing those books. I will take hope into the voting booth in November of 2020. So thank you.
Thank you, Arnie. It's been great to be with you.
Stick around, everyone. We'll be right back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins.
Technology goes out on a limb for clean water on this current cast. Trees slow, absorb, and purify rainfall. That helps decrease runoff and stormwater pollution. Now, a software tool called iTree Hydro helps city and regional planners measure the exact water benefits of tree cover versus impervious services in their community. Ted Andreni of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry says by simulating the impacts of adding more trees,
the model will illustrate reduction in the total volume of stormwater, the slowing of the peak stormwater, and a reduction in the total amount of pollutants in the stormwater.
This provides information that communities can use to better protect their local waters. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Much to my own drum, much to my own drum. Hey, hey, I'm an army of one. Oh, I'm an army of one. Much to my own drum, much to my own drum. Hey, hey, I'm an army of one. Oh, I'm an army of one. Ren is back in here cause she don't like Mondays. Underpaid teacher, police in the hallways. Print yourself a weapon and take it to the gun range. Cut the you ain't going to the gun range. Standing with Emma and her sons and daughters, watching our youth have to solve our problems. I follow them, so who's coming with me? Half of you love me, half already hate me. March to my own.
Welcome back to part two of the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Again, a reminder that we Zoom this show on Wednesday, so if something should happen on the evening of July 1st, we're not going to be discussing it, but this will be airing on July 2nd. I go to Slate.com a lot. God, I'm getting to love the writers at Slate.com. One of my faves, Mark Joseph Stern, I'm telling you, the guy's a genius. So now I get to find another genius. This is even more exciting. I see an article that's entitled, "There is a way to reopen schools this fall. Do we have the will to make it happen?" Joining us right now is the author of this piece, Rebecca Onion, and I want to welcome Rebecca to the program. Thank you so much for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me. This is one of my favorite topics.
So tell me a little bit about Rebecca. I learned a lot about Mark Joseph Stern because I've interviewed him 1,000 times now. But I know a lot about Dahlia Lithwick, and I've been sort of following them, and Joshua Keating. I really do mind Slate. But I'd love to know a little bit about Rebecca. So not only is this a favorite topic, but let people know a little bit about you as we get into this favorite topic.
Oh, sure. Well, let's see. I came to journalism from academia. I have a PhD in American Studies. And so I love to write stuff that connects current events with history. That's one of my favorite angles. But I'm also really interested in childhood and parenting, American culture, and what it looks like in American culture. That's something I read about academically, but I'm now writing about it for Slate.com.
Well, and as I understand, you also come from a family of two teachers. I came from a family of two teachers. So
that's
education,
right.
it's in our DNA. We have no choice.
That's right.
We really never have become teachers, but in a lot of ways, we've never sort of lost the concern and thinking about it because we understand the life of teachers. And as a result, we see this pandemic, and we can't even imagine the challenges going forward. So you did a really interesting thing in this piece. In fact, I just sent it out. I sent your article out to a number of people who are running for office in 2020. And the reason I sent it out is that you frame the issue in a very important way. I want you to explain to my audience how you got to this framing, because I think the evolution of how you got here is important. And then I think it also becomes helpful as we look at going into the fall, because you put education into the right place. It's not a separate silo. It really is going to be looked at from the gestalt. And then you explain why by putting it there, we understand the choices we need to make.
Oh, yes. Okay, so let's see. I do not have a child in public school right now. My child is only 3. And luckily or unluckily, my husband doesn't have a job, so he's been able to take care of her. So I'm not like living this problem the way that all of my friends are. But I have a lot of friends who are living this problem. I think what first for months has sort of happened is that we talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. We just feel like we're between a rock and a hard place. Okay, so we can't open the schools up because it would be really, really, really hard to get kids to conform to social distancing, to pay the amount of money that needs to get paid, to do all the cleaning, all the sanitizing. A lot of teachers and staff are in high-risk groups, and we can't ask them to take that risk. And then on the other hand, you have the parents going, oh my God, I can't do this. Like, this is not working. And so for parents who have moms that let them work from home, they're lucky enough to do that. But it's just like, depending on the age of the kid, it might be easier or harder, but just having a kid in your house who needs things from you and needs to be taught and needs to interact with you is somewhere between really irritating and frustrating and also heartbreaking. I have a lot of friends who say the hardest part about it is they just feel so guilty all the time. Well, they're exhausted, but they also just feel so guilty that they can't give their kid what they want, what they should. And then you think about the people who have to go out to work, and what are their kids supposed to do? So there's just been this sort of, you know, go back and forth.
And there's one more silo, Rebecca. There's one more silo. And it's the people that don't have the internet connection, the computer.
Oh, yes.
All that. And I mean, we have not been able to find, Rebecca, this is a really important story for the future for you for Slate. I keep asking, do we know from all the different superintendents and all the different school districts in my state, how many kids rarely, if ever, showed up? In the sense that there was no internet connection. They literally fell through the cracks. So while they may have parents at home, that's fine. But if you don't have the connectivity, you can't afford the connectivity, you don't have the kind of computers you need, what the hell do you do? A lot of schools have not reported these numbers, and we need to factor in those numbers as well as we look at the dynamic that you were just describing, going to work, when your kids have to be homeschooled, being home and having to homeschool. Then we have this whole group that are like in Never Never Land.
Yes, and I know that some people have been doing things like, I think it was a story in the Huffington Post recently about a mom who was taking her 16-year-old to the parking lot of McDonald's and like sitting in the car with her, with their siblings in the back seat, so she could do her schoolwork. But stuff like that, like, you shouldn't have to do that. And then, of course, there's the problem where, you know, that meant the mom couldn't have a job. Like, basically, she wasn't even trying because she just felt like it was too impossible. This is a single mom, I think. So it's just like, you know, there's so many different ways that things can go wrong for people. As you quite rightly say, the perfect situation almost doesn't seem to exist. Yet there's this like idea that somehow it'll be okay, or that somehow parents will like make do or find a way, and a disconnect, what it seems, between parents saying like, this is impossible, I can't do this, and the discourse, which is just like, well, you have to because we can't open schools. And I think that that feels like a very familiar place to me, because I'm a veteran of conversations around parenting that have to do with other impossibilities, like how expensive daycare is in big cities and other places. You know, I'm fortunate enough to live in a place where it's not as expensive as other places, but it's still like a lot. And parents are constantly having to make do with that. Things like school not being in session during the summer or after 3 o'clock, and parents having work that goes through those times and trying to figure out what to do with the kids in a system where the assumption seems to be that one parent is going to be available to pick them up and be with them. So there's, there's a familiarity to this.
Look, a little sidebar here. We were one of the last states in the nation to have mandatory kindergarten, and then we finally embraced the idea of full-day kindergarten. Do you know who is the biggest proponent of full-day kindergarten? The business community. The business community, why did they want full-day kindergarten? Because parents were navigating what to do. We're in the middle of their workday.
Yeah.
Their kid would be in kindergarten, and then where the hell do they go? And so it's ironic. Everybody's, it's such an educational opportunity. I'm looking at the biggest advocates being the business community, because they wanted the frickin' stability of knowing that their employees didn't have to worry about this. But you said how the idea of reopening schools in a very different way. We have to frame the question differently. Let's talk about how we have to reframe it, because it really then does change a lot of other things as we approach reopening the economy, masking up, social distancing. You put education in part of that continuum, but you need to explain how you get there.
Okay, so I can't totally take credit for the idea. This is an idea that I saw from the epidemiologist Helen Jenkins, who works at BU, and she has two elementary aged kids. And so she said, and it's interesting because I feel like in a way, her ability to reframe it came in part from her just being a scientist. Like, I think she just was like, well, obviously this is what we should do. So her thing was, okay, we're stuck in this position, but we're not sort of seeing that in an ideal world. So imagine that everyone really cared about kids getting education and parents being able to function, families being able to function. Then we could do a thing where we imagine the total amount of risk as a community that we're willing to take. So I was thinking about this in relationship to an idea that Tara Parker Pope floated in the New York Times about the idea of viral risk exposure budgets. So the idea is that within a family, her concept was, inside a family, you might have a certain amount of risk that you're comfortable with. And of course, that might be subjective based on the level of virus in your area, what your underlying conditions are, all of that. And then operating from that, you might decide to do some things and not do others, you know, trying to keep your exposure below a certain level. So I've already made choices like that, and I'm sure you probably have too, where I have said I am not going to go to the gym because I really want to be able to go on a walk with my friends, and I feel weird about bringing that exposure into their lives. So this is like not a science, it's kind of an art, but the idea of like your total exposure accumulation being something that you can kind of make choices around, that really resonated with me. And then what Helen Jenkins' idea does is say, you know, in an ideal world, we as a community, as a culture, as a society could be saying the number one most important thing is for the kids to be able to be educated and the parents to be able to function. So in order to do that, we are going to prioritize reopening schools. So once you have the everything else within the community that you're doing sort of like working towards that goal, you might make choices like, we are not going to reopen indoor dining because we need to be able to keep our exposure level, keep everything, keep the amount of virus that's circulating at a low enough level that when we do reopen schools, which at this point would be, you know, in August or September, what's going on within the school in terms of the sanitation, the distancing protocols, all of that stuff would just, would still matter, but it would matter kind of less because the school would be drawing from a smaller pool of circulating virus.
I'll listen to you. I suddenly realized I've got a risk bank and I'm looking at my risk bank and I'm thinking, okay, I only have a limited amount of dollars in my risk bank.
Yeah.
How am I going to spend my dollars? This is what I'm hearing from you. And I'm going,
I
want to eat at a restaurant indoors? No, I don't need to do that. So that's, I'm not using my risk bank for that. Do I want to go to the gym? No, I'm not going to use my risk bank for that. Do I want to go to the beach? No, I'm not going to use my risk bank for that. What am I willing to use my risk bank for? And as you point out, that as you start triaging those dollars and realizing where you're going to make the risk investment, education is not only essential for your kids, it's essential for the family sanity. It's essential for your being able to produce any kind of work for an economy. It's essential because you don't want these kids to lose that time. I mean, when you look at it that way, it's almost like you want to give everyone a bank account. And it's a personal bank account, and then you've got the community bank account. And once you do it that way, then it's not, it's like an obvious choice. It's not like, oh, I'm pissed because I can't go indoors, or I'm ticked off because I can't go to the beach. What you suddenly realize is, no, you can do this, but then look what you've given up.
Yes, that's it. And I think, I mean, I think to you and I, it's an obvious choice. First of all, there's a problem that this hasn't been framed this way in the conversation, I don't think.
Exactly.
Like, I've seen people say, oh my God, please put a mask on because I want my kids to be able to go back to school. Like that kind of thing. But then also, like, just the way that this thing has unfolded in this rolling way, people making different decisions at state level, local level, federal level, making no decisions, just letting things develop in this way that seems like very uncontrolled. This reframing that Helen Jenkins is doing is like, it's sort of like,
it's brilliant.
That's why I say that I think she had to be a scientist to say that. Like, just as a, you know, someone looking at the way the whole society and culture is operating, I'm like, man, that's a beautiful dream. But it's
It's a math problem, Rebecca. It's a math problem. And you want one side to equal the other side. You know, you can have 5 + 1 = 6. You can have 3 + 3 = 6. And there are different inputs to get into this quality. Well, you've got the same thing with the risk. You know, what is it that, what is the goal? The goal is to get your kids into school that's safe, and what's the rationale for it? In order to get to that point, what kind of behaviors do I need to see personally? Do I need to see with my community? That frankly, I need to see with my state because I need my state as backup because communities don't live in isolation. And what you get is not only a different framing, but it, how do I say it? You're holding people's hands so they get to understand why you're doing what you're doing. And I think that there could then be consensus. Okay, I'm willing to not go to a restaurant. I'm willing to not go to the gym, not because I don't want to, not because it wouldn't fit with my personal lifestyle, but if it's bad for my community and it's bad for my state and it's bad for my kids, then maybe I can delay this because I don't need it because it's more important that the economy function and kids get an education.
I 100% agree with you. What I worry about, and I try not to dwell on this too much because I wonder how much this is just people being jerks on the internet, but I do think that, you know, whenever someone on Twitter says, you know, puts a despairing tweet. Oh my God, does everyone realize that parents still don't have childcare and are still trying to do their jobs? There are a lot of replies that kind of are like, oh, like if you didn't want to deal with it, you shouldn't have had kids. Like, or, you know, like that kind of like, it's like an unsympathetic kind of like just buck up kind of attitude. But it's familiar from other.
There are more of us. First of all, I think in the long run.
Gosh, I hope you're right.
And I think the business community is getting a come to Jesus moment. And I'm looking at the fact that I'm seeing Mitch McConnell wear a mask, and I'm watching, you know, I mean, I'm watching all these Republicans suddenly getting masked up, you know, because they're beginning to take some of the conversation we're having right now, and they're draining some of the venom and some of the partisanship out of it. And as long as they continue to do that with the drumbeat, I think what you are framing and how you framed it is giving people an opportunity to begin to look at this in a bigger picture and where education fits in. And I want to share something with you. So I
hope you're right.
At elementary school. The whole daycare thing is a problem. Mm-hmm. And the idea of staggering is a problem. Can we have kids go half a day? Well, what happens on the other half of the day? Can we have kids go other day? Well, what happens on the every other day? So let me make my pitch to Rebecca Onion. And I want you to focus around the education community. So what we do know is you're talking about, you know, framing this, you know, making these risk choices. Well, one of the risks we probably won't be making is to go to the theater, to go to our big theaters for, like, performances, musical events, or whatever. But then we have these huge institutions that exist in a lot of cities, big and small, and they're going to be empty. And they have kitchens, and they have bathrooms, and they have spaces. And here was my recommendation to the principal across the street. We have a huge theater downtown, literally blocks from the school, like four blocks from the school. And it's going to be empty probably for the next year. So here was my recommendation. You need more physical space. You don't have it. We need more daycare. We don't have it. So how do we create the illusion of both? And what I said to her was, what if we had half the kids go to school for academics? Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and then it flips on the other week. And on the opposite day, when the other kids aren't going to school, they go to the big theater. And they go to the big theater where they can socially distance. And the art teacher is permanently placed there. And the music teacher is permanently placed there. And the theater teacher is permanently placed there. And the special ed additional help with kids is permanently placed there. So rather than go home to a house where a parent is either working or there's no daycare, or they can't do their work at home, those kids are getting an investment in music and art and theater and extracurricular in a separate space. And yet what that does is it eases the pressure on the school. It then uses that facility that they could actually get paid some kind of compensation because the feds or the state or something could pay them for using that space for the year. That will keep them afloat, okay? And what you've got is a kind of seamless 5 days a week of school, but school now has a slightly different location, and there's a different reason for going to one space than to another. But what you've done is you've given yourself an expanded footprint. You've created greater safety. You've given parents an opportunity to work, whether it's work at home or work away, and you don't have to put the pressure on a daycare system that doesn't freaking exist.
Yeah. I mean, I love that idea because, I mean, that is one of the big worries about these, like, 2 days on, 3 days off kind of things, is that parents are just going to scramble for childcare on the other days that will result in more exposure.
And think of the gym.
So they can keep them with each other.
So if you don't, if you're closing down a gym, guess what? Here's a way of using that gym, giving them some compensation while they wait for the other side. And then your kids can go to that gym with their teachers there where they can socially distance, they can bring their lunch or do whatever. I think we have to be creative. But the idea of spending kids home ain't an answer. Thinking you're going to come up with more daycare ain't an answer. Let's start looking at those risk factors that you were talking about, which is why I loved your article, and saying, okay, so these certain places probably can't open until we figure out what to do with COVID. But since they're large and they're physical and they exist within a community, how do we reuse them, give them support, and at the same time, continue education in a way where kids literally get taught?
I love the idea. Now you have to have the government be willing to give some money for that.
They will. They're going to have to come up, no matter what happens.
They have to.
They have to anyway. Let's use these dollars in a double win. It's a double win. You're keeping your public entertainment spaces open to a point where at least they can pay their rent. You're keeping your gyms open at least to the point where they can pay their mortgage. Whatever it is, they're not going to be making money, but they're not going to be diving into despair, because you have at least given them some kind of safety net. And at the same time, that gives them that year and a half to breathe, and you get the additional space you need so kids can get educated and get safe. And then I'm going to be a real jerk here, Rebecca. I love the idea of theater and music and art being given its fair due. And by doing this, we have invested in things that, especially in a public institution, we've always sort of drained out of the public system. And now they get to celebrate what they are, what they do in such a way that I think kids' learning will improve.
Oh, no, I agree. And that could be a side benefit, is that at the end of however long it is of that, people might say, hey, that was great.
Exactly.
I see more of that.
So, Rebecca, you read this teacher. You read this. Listen to what I'm saying, which is one of the reasons why I was so excited about reading your article, because we think the same way. This idea of this risk bank or this risk evaluation is absolutely crucial. But what I want us to think about too is, let's also have a different set of eyes and a different set of expectations. Let's look at what we're asking to close because of that risk. And let's figure out, is there a way for us to still invest in those things that are being kind of sacrificed and keep them somewhat afloat, not doing what they originally do, but then be able to do it so that they can come out the other side and everyone sort of knows that we had each other's back.
I love it. Now, what did the principal say when you proposed this?
Well, I proposed it to about five or six other teachers. Here's what I haven't talked to the principal. Here's what I did. Here's how I started. The person who runs the big theater in town happens to rent a little tiny efficiency in my house because she has a big home in Vermont, but she has to spend a lot of late nights here. Well, she's not spending late nights here. So she's the one that told me that she's probably going to have to shut down for the year. So I said to her, Nikki, I got this idea. Because remember, I know her, and I'm across the street from an elementary school. I said, here's my idea. What do you think? And I can't even tell you, she went to the moon. She said, Arnie, that could work. I said, I know. So what you can do is start, since you're the education journalist at Slate, start going to educators. Start going to people who own these big gyms or these big orchestra houses or whatever they are, and start saying, is this a way to do it? I think we have to be inventive, but we can also reuse these spaces in a new way because they're already there and they won't be used. But guess what? If we can use them for this, we may have created a whole new dynamic for how we see theater going into the future, how we see art going into the future, and how we know that we want both to be sustained.
I love it. Yeah, that'd be a good story. I should investigate this.
Well, Rebecca Onion, you wrote a good story. And that's why I wanted to grab you, because I needed to think about how to reframe the priority of school. And you gave me the way to do it. And so my job on this show is to also plant the seed with you and say, that's the risk factor. Now that we understand the risk factor, how can we still understand that there are ways that we need to still take some risk out of opening schools with that idea of giving people more physical space? But you can't ask a school to, you know, rebuild in a matter of a week. But we're going to have a lot of empty structures that, guess what, could be reused to accommodate academia.
That's it. Spaces.
It is absolutely incredible. Rebecca Onion, I'm glad Slate.com found you. Keep writing for them. Keep reading all that stuff. And this is the kind of creative thinking we need. And we have enough time between now and the fall to begin to put those pieces together. It's not going to be a switch. We're going to make some mistakes. Yeah. But we have to understand the priority that education is within our schools and our economy. And once we get that, I think the solutions will follow. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
All right. Rebecca Onion writes for Slate.com. Her piece at Slate.com was entitled, There is a Way to Reopen Schools This Fall. Do we have the operative word will, W-I-L-L, to make it happen? Join us again.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. This is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artisan. Let me thank my producer, Stephanie Collins, and Dave Scott. We'll schmooze tomorrow. You better-